Every day, Bill Frank...
We're going to be doing one thing and one thing only.
...talks with the best guests in America about business.
You mean business?
Monkey business?
Are you ready to get down to business?
All right! Everybody's here and that means we can get down to business.
Entertainment.
Entertainment.
The entertainment capital of the world.
What kind of entertainment?
It's a storm of entertainment that brings down the house.
Sports.
Game on.
A grueling test of strength, speed, and stamina.
Wow, just like in the pros.
And the local community.
The rage in local radio.
Find out what's going on locally.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time now for the Bill Frank Radio Show on News Talk 1520 KVTA. Now, here's your host.
Bill Frank.
Hi, this is Bill Frank, and you're listening to the Bill Frank Radio Show on KVTA News Talk 1520. You can also hear me streaming over the internet at brainstormingonline.com. I'm bringing fresh perspectives to Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. My goal is to bring you interviews with thought leaders in business, entertainment, sports, and the local community. Together, we'll listen to what these people say and relate it to how we live and work in Ventura and Santa Barbara. The Bill Frank Radio Show is smart radio with sharp questions aimed at intelligent guests. It's talk radio done right for the 21st century. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is business and politics. Each of my guests will discuss one of these two topics. My next guest takes us inside the war room of campaigns on the left and the right to show how the smartest campaigns now believe they know who you will vote for even before you do. We'll discuss his latest book, The Victory Lab. Sasha Eisenberg is the Washington correspondent for Monocle. He covered the 2008 presidential campaign for the Boston Globe as the national political reporter, and he's written for George and Philadelphia magazines. He's the author of The Sushi Economy. His new column at Slate is called The Victory Lab that covers much of the book's focus. He lives in Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia, joining us from the East Coast. Hi, Sasha. How are you doing today?
Fine, thanks. How are you, Bill?
Terrific, and thanks for being a guest. Interesting book about how the science and scientific method is being introduced into the campaigns. And where I'd like to start, or the best place to start, I think, is with the 2010 U.S. Senate race in Colorado. How did Hal Malchow influence the outcome of the election between Democrat Michael Bennett and Tea Party candidate Ken Buck?
Yeah, Malchow is this Democratic direct mail consultant who's one of the main characters in my book. And before the election, he sent 1 million letters to Colorado voters who looked from their sort of data profiles likely to be Democratic voters. And the letter was very simple. It said, "I want to thank you for, dear voter. I can see from public records that you voted in the 2008 election. I want to thank you for taking the time to be a voter. There's another election coming up shortly, and I hope afterwards I can thank you for being a voter again." And it was a simple letter in an envelope. It was an incredibly sort of loud and rancorous, ideologically intense time in American politics, and these letters did not make sort of any reference to any of that. They were designed with a very subtle psychological mechanism in mind, getting people to want to live up to this standard that had been presented to them of being voters and knowing that they were sort of very quietly being watched. And experiments had shown that 2.5% increase in turnout comes from that type of treatment through these randomized control trials that people in politics like Malchow had run. And so, by that math, he would have moved 25,000 votes, which is more than Bennett's ultimate margin of victory over Buck.
So he clearly had an impact in the 2010 Senate race in the state of Colorado. Now, Colorado typically leans Democratic anyway. Was Colorado predisposed to electing Bennett instead of Buck simply because of its political orientation?
Yeah, I mean, so a lot of things I'm writing about in the book are things that have been measured to sort of get a 2 or 3 or 5% improvement in turnout or sort of using data to find efficiencies in targeting people also for a few points. They can't change the sort of overall structure of a race. We ultimately know very little about where people's opinions come from, how they necessarily make up their minds, and people are in certain ways very predictable. Democrats tend to vote Democratic, Republicans tend to vote Republican. But we see in these very tight races that obviously these small things can make a huge difference. And so if Bennett had been a horrible candidate or he'd been running in Mississippi, you could have sent you know, a gazillion letters with all sorts of psychological impacts, and you probably wouldn't have fundamentally changed the dynamics in the race. But these little things can have these marginal impacts. And since 2000, I think it's very easy to convince both people in politics to invest in research that will show how to get 2% better. And I think it's easy for voters to understand why campaigns are now interested in focusing so much attention on finding that next 2%. And the polls this year, I think, probably, you know, reflect, I think everybody understands what 2% might be able to do in November in one way or the other to influence the outcome of this presidential election.
Makes a lot of sense. My guest is Sasha Eisenberg, author of the book The Victory Lab. So, Sasha, the bigger question then is, if the Democrats did such a good job in Colorado influencing that election, why didn't the Democrats expand that to other elections across the country in 2010? I mean, they got walloped in the mid-year or midterm elections.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it was that, you know, public opinion was turned against Democrats. It was a bad year to be a Democrat, and that, you know, a lot of Democrats are losing races by more than 2%. That's part of the reason, and that's sort of a steady issue in all these campaigns. And none of these psychological tricks are going to get somebody to, you know, are going to get a Romney voter to vote for Barack Obama or vice versa. But they are little things that can be done to get people who might not normally vote, might not be habitual voters, to change their behavior. The other big reason is that I write about these sort of, you know, maverick researchers like Malchow, who has certainly worked in politics. He's worked for, you know, like four Democratic presidential nominees, but also people outside of it, behavioral psychologists in academia and people coming from the commercial marketing world. And a lot of their innovations have not been as readily accepted by people in the political world as you might expect. You know, the people have compared my book to Moneyball for politics, and I think that there's a lot of cultural analogies to what happened in sports over the last decade and what's happened in politics. And in sports, the sort of geeks were up against the scouts and the managers who were sort of seen as wise men who made decisions from their gut, and they had to convince a world that had grown up celebrating that type of wisdom that there were insights that you can get from data that that might go against the traditional practice. And in politics, it's very similar. There's a sort of, you know, cast of professional consultants and campaign managers who are used to doing things in a certain way, and you have now this sort of generation of geeks who are coming in and saying, hey, we can use these experiments to actually measure cause and effect. We should be looking more at these universal psychological mechanisms than trying to just talk about candidates and issues in a particular race. We can get all this new data from the commercial world and try to refine our understanding of who votes and why and how we should talk to them. And so even though some of these things like Malchow's letters in Colorado have been accepted in certain parts of the political world, they're by no means universal. And I think that tension still exists. And there are a lot of sort of old guard political operatives who really resist anything new or different.
So you're saying that this pits the gurus, if you will, the ones that are the old guard political consultants versus the geeks. Are we seeing a shift right now, Sasha, between the old guard and the geeks? Are the old guard giving way to the geeks and the more scientific methods?
I think so. I mean, I think definitely on the left, the Obama campaign in 08 has had a significant and sort of enduring impact. I mean, it was such a massive campaign and brought in so many new people to politics, both, you know, 22-year-olds who'd never worked on campaigns before, but also people who had other expertise. I tell the story of, you know, how in California during the Democratic primary in 2008, a graduate student in econometrics at UC Berkeley walked into an Obama campaign headquarters and had never worked in a campaign before, but his scholarly background was in making economic forecasting models. And he basically got access to the campaign's data on California voters, and he started messing around with it the way you sort of expect he would. And instead of trying to predict, you know, what GDP was going to be in 2 years, he was trying to predict whether an individual voter would support Barack Obama. And he ended up working in the campaign, and there are other people like him. And that's an example of, you know, knowledge and problem-solving sophistication coming in from areas outside politics and changing it. And the Obama campaign was particularly welcoming to that approach. And slowly we see on the left, because of it, that people who sort of got their shot or came of age, you know, junior people who sort of grew up interacting with that type of data, and even in junior roles on the Obama campaign in 08 are now moving into more senior positions at the party or other campaigns. And we're starting to see a generational turnover, but it's slow, and there's still a lot of people in campaigns who represent the old guard, and many of them control budgets and decision-making and aren't giving way easily.
My guest is Sasha Eisenberg, author of the book, The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns. So, Sasha, should we as citizens be concerned about this trend?
I don't think all too much. I think we have a right to be concerned. There's tons of data about us, most of it not coming from the political world, a lot of it coming from when you fill out a warranty form or a customer service questionnaire and you check a box that your household income is between $50,000 and $75,000 or that you're a high school graduate. That information is being stored somewhere. It has gone into shaping your credit scores, and now it's going into shaping similar sorts of predictions that campaigns make about you. And also the information that when somebody knocks on your door or somebody calls during dinner and asks you, hey, I just want to ask you a few questions about the election. Who do you plan to vote? Who do you plan to vote for? What issues do you care about? That information is going into a database, too, and isn't going away anytime soon. And so I think people always should be concerned about that level of individual data. But both ends of this, I think both the huge amounts of individual data and the use of these experiments and moving towards sort of more psychologically complex understandings of what motivates people to vote are giving campaigns a sort of more sensitive, nuanced understanding of the human brain and are treating people as individuals so that they don't have to speak to you and your neighbor in the same way or about the same issues or assume that you're responsive to the same types of engagement. And I think that's generally encouraging. I think our politics has sort of gotten more humanistic over the last decade because of it, and campaigns are recognizing the value of having, real volunteers talk to other people. It's one reason I think that there's been a sort of outpouring of a volunteer culture in our politics, and I'm broadly heartened by all of that.
All right. My guest is Sasha Eisenberg. So, Sasha, all of this data mining that you're referring to, collecting all of the data and pooling it and so forth, really boils down to two techniques that you outline in the book, micro-targeting and randomizing. Briefly describe what those two techniques are.
Sure. Randomizing is the tools that pharmaceutical companies, for example, use to test their drugs. So they give one group of people a drug, and they give another group and a control group, and they see, does the drug influence one set of outcomes more than the other? Political world has adopted this, and the voters are the guinea pigs, and instead of randomly assigning drugs, they're randomly assigning pieces of mail or phone calls or web ads. And then they can go back and they can measure, if they want to see what effects turnout, they can go back and look at the voter files that are kept by counties or local officials, and they can see who voted and who didn't and attribute the difference and cause and effect to the randomization. So campaigns are doing this on a broad level, or they can see if it changed your mind through polling as a way of finally being able to see what works and what doesn't in campaigns. The data is has been about combining this information that's on your voter registration record, that the stuff that's your name, your address, your age, your gender, sometimes your race, with information from other sources. It's commercial information that they're getting off, from these commercial databases that they're buying, and the information that's coming in from the phone calls and canvassers in the field. And so what they're doing is they're taking what are often now thousands of data points about each individual, matching them up against polling about public opinion, and they're able to make a prediction about how they think you're going to vote. And so it's basically the political world's version of credit scores. And so where financial institutions, before they issue you a loan, want to make a prediction of how likely you are to pay off your bill on time, or how likely you are to borrow more than $1,000 in a month on your car, or how likely you are to pay to default on it. The political world campaigns want to make a prediction of how likely you are to go out and cast a ballot, how likely you are to vote for Barack Obama, how likely you are to be pro-choice. And so the campaign, the Obama campaign has a set of scores for every individual adult in the country, and they're framed as a percentage probability, and they represent each of those probabilities, the likelihood that you'll vote for Barack Obama. And so the same way that a loan officer will want to see your scores before they decide to issue you a loan at a bank, a campaign field worker will look at your scores to make a determination as to whether they should have somebody knock on your door or whether they should send mail to your house. And that's totally transformed the way that campaigns sort of figure out who to talk to. They're no longer restrained by thinking in terms of broad geographies, like we're going to deal in this district and not in that county, or big demographic categories like race or age or education level, but can start to treat each individual voter very differently.
My guest is Sasha Eisenberg, author of the book, The Victory Lap. Sasha, the examples that we've been talking about have been mostly Democratic examples. However, this is also being embraced by the Republicans. Alexander Gage in Mitt Romney's gubernatorial race in Massachusetts was involved in this. How effectively are the Republicans using this, and how effectively do you think they'll use it in the 2012 presidential campaign?
I think that, you know, Romney has been working with this guy, Alex Gage, since his first gubernatorial race in 2002. They were sort of pioneers of this micro-targeting, and I think Romney's background in the corporate world made him sort of more, and his inner circle at the time made him more welcoming of these, a lot of these methods that have been first developed in commercial marketing. And he's remained at the sort of forefront in his 2008 campaign of using data to target voters. They are still very much playing catch up against the Obama campaign in 2008. In 2012. One of the great benefits of being a presidential reelection campaign is that you're able, for 4 years, to sort of think like a corporation in a way that many short-term political campaigns aren't able to. And so, the Obama campaign has sort of laid out a bunch of questions starting in November of 2008 that it wanted to answer, and has had access to, you know, probably all told over $1 billion and control of the Democratic National Committee to try to answer them. And the Romney campaign, despite the presence of some very smart people in Boston, is still, in analytical terms, playing catch-up.
My guest has been Sasha Eisenberg, author of the book, The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns. Sasha, you have probably piqued the interest of many of my listeners who are out there. If they want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go?
My website is thevictorylab, that's lab with a B, .com, and there's information about me and about the book and places to order it online or to find a local bookseller.
Sasha, it has been a delight. Thank you so much for being my special guest here on The Bill Frank Show. We'll talk to you down the road.
Great. Thanks for having me, Bill.